Yeah, so welcome everyone. We're on this journey through both the system of practice and the mandala of the five Buddhas over the course of the year. And in the going deeper sessions, we wanted to kind of track that, but in a more sort of even way than perhaps the Sangha monks are doing. So we didn't want to compress the receptivity bit. So we're currently on receptivity, the theme of receptivity with the going deeper sessions. You'll notice the shrine is still a Ratnasambhava shrine, but over the course of the year we're associating receptivity with Antara. So I'm just saying this by way of positioning you. And having said that, this particular association of a system of practice with the five Buddha mandala is completely arbitrary, and really, if you want to associate receptivity with anything, I think it's the blue sky. So you start a visualization practice with the clear, open blue sky, and then within that, one of the Buddhas or Bodhisattva figures emerges. And it's not necessarily Amitabha, it could be Amitabha, it could be another figure. But in a way, if I'm using a symbol today, this afternoon, it's a symbol of the blue sky, the open space. Space of receptivity. And something that the Santra emphasised, which really stayed with me, is that it's really important that receptivity includes a receptivity to Adhisthana, to the blessings of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, a sort of receptivity to the three jewels. In fact, that's the whole idea, really. Okay, so what I had in mind today is to sort of present a way in to that sort of receptivity to Adhisthana that's symbolised by the clear blue sky. It's just a way in. It's a way in that I found useful myself. And it's based around a verse of teaching by a Tibetan lama called Mifam. So Mifam lived around about 1910, I think. And he sort of weaves into what I like to think about lineage. So Bhante's eight main teachers included Yamyam Khyentse Choky Lodro, who was perhaps the senior most Nyingma Tibetan Buddhist back in the 50s. And he did actually meet Mifam briefly way back in the early 1900s, and got some teachings from him. Mifam was a very important figure in the Nyingma tradition. And Mifam himself met as a student of the previous Yamyam Khyentse Wangpo, who was a very key figure in the mid-19th century. So and he was what's called a Rime master. There was a unification of all the Tibetan traditions, well, three of the Tibetan traditions. Which they did by just initiating each other into all of the empowerments. So they would have not just the Nyingma empowerments, but the Chakipa and the Kagyupa empowerments as well. So that was very much a sort of coming back to the spirit of practice and not being kind of rigid about boundaries. So in a way, it was a sort of critical ecumenicalism, which is part of the spirit in which Sri Lanka was founded as well. So that's just a little bit of background, of where Mifam sits. So I'll just drop in the verse, and then I'll talk about the verse. It's very steep. A lot of these verses are, in a way, it's a sort of description of enlightenment. And yet, I found it useful as a path as well as a way in. Okay, so I'll just drop in the verses. Looking into the very face of the true nature of mind, which is beyond attraction and aversion, which is beginningless and unfabricated, the primordial purity of the immaculate Dharmakaya, within which all appearances arise like magical illusions. These illusionary appearances are the very nature of the Guru, the inseparability of form and emptiness. So I'll drop that in one more time, and then I'm just going to be going through it line by line and sort of saying what we can use, how we can use it. Looking into the very face of the true nature of mind, which is beyond attraction and aversion, which is beginningless and unfabricated, the primordial purity of the immaculate Dharmakaya, within which all appearances arise like magical illusions. These illusionary appearances are the very nature of the Guru, the inseparability of form and emptiness. So the first line is about seeing directly, looking into the very face. So to look into the very face is to see directly, to see immediately, unobscured, unveiled, manifest and present. So you may know this alternative quote from a source which I very, very rarely use. When I was a child, I saw as through a glass darkly, but now face to face. So you might recognise that. So I very, very rarely quote from the Bible. But I think that's actually expressing something about seeing directly and what that means.
Can you say that again?
When I was a child, I saw as through a glass darkly, but now face to face. So just take an example. So you might know of someone, you might have heard tale of them, you might even have heard a recording of them speak, giving a talk. Maybe this is Bhante. But when you meet them in person, face to face, there's a possibility for direct communication and for knowing them directly. And that possibility is just so much greater face to face. So that's looking into the very face. And the first line saying, looking into the very face of the true nature of mind. So my suggestion, I think at this point, just take it as a suggestion and run with it and see if it works for you. My suggestion is that the true nature of mind is pure awareness. And I'm going to talk in terms of awareness, where Mifam's talking in terms of the nature of mind. So take that as a suggestion, see if it works for the purposes of this morning.
Could you just speak
up? Okay, yeah. Okay, it is useful to think in terms of what's the nature of my experience rather than what's the content of my experience. You know, perhaps particularly if you're in sort of prapancha, it's not very helpful to think in terms of what's the content of the thoughts. It's more helpful to think in terms of how is it to be having this experience? What's the nature of my experience at the moment?
There was a word we used. You said when you're in prapancha.
Prapancha.
What's that?
It's used to mean a succession of thoughts in a very prolific and undirected sort of way. Literally, it means quintuplification. multiplying by five. So you go from 1 to 5 to 25, it all explodes. So.
Yeah,
it's quite a symbolic
sense.
Number.
It makes sense to me, yeah. In my mind.
So it's useful to think in terms of, so what's the nature of this experience? How is it to be having this experience rather than what's the content? So we're not particularly looking at, well, what's the content of mind? But whatever's apparent in the content, we're sort of more interested in what's the nature. And particularly we're interested in, so what's the nature of being aware of this experience? Yeah. So that's looking into the very face of the true nature of mind. And then you can take the next bit as a sort of how to go about that. So indicating a way into pure awareness or the nature of mind by bringing awareness to anything that's there in experience. So anything that's there in experience is not itself pure awareness. And anything which has a quality of attraction or aversion to it, yeah, is not itself pure awareness. So lurking into the very face, the true nature of mind, which is beyond attraction and aversion. So pure awareness is something that's beyond attraction and aversion. And that means that any experience we have that has this quality of a push or a pull to it, however subtle, is not itself pure awareness, and that means that it is itself something we can bring awareness to. You know, we don't have to identify with it. Yeah. So the slightest tinge of intentionality, of being drawn towards, being pushing away, is an experience that you can bring awareness to. Now, Buddhism generally, particularly Pali Canon, is very keen to distinguish feeling tone from intention. Pleasant and unpleasant is feeling tone. Attraction and aversion is intention. It's very keen to distinguish that for a good reason, that the intentionality is karmically formative, it's setting up experience for the future. Feeling tone isn't. Having said that, there is it's more of a continuum. It's not a clear, distinct break. So you can go from pleasant, unpleasant, to like this, don't like that, to want more of this, don't want so much of that, to out and out craving and aversion. And there's a whole spectrum in there. And quite when karma actually first starts, it's quite a subtle thing to try and distinguish. But in this context, we're just sort of noting that, well, anything with any tinge of attraction or aversion is something that we can bring awareness to. And something that's called presence language, I find, can really help. It's such coming from focusing, but it's a way of kind of getting some space around not identifying so strongly. It's particularly helpful if you are identified. So it's like, I really want this. You know, it's me that really wants this. That's where I identified. Presence language would say, oh, something in me really wants me to have this experience. Yeah? Mm-hmm. Or something in me really doesn't want me to have to experience this. Yeah? So it enables you to bring awareness too, because you're not identifying with so much. And then the practice is the one that I've probably been encouraging in pretty much all the sessions I've been leading, particularly in the positive emotion ones. Bringing awareness to being with a kindly awareness, with a sensitive presence, not trying to fix anything, not trying to make anything better, just in the same way that you might spend time being with a friend of yours, however they are. If they're anxious, you can be with them in their anxiety. If they're distressed, you can be with them in their distress. And you're not trying to come up with a solution and make it all better. So that's a sort of embodied presence, sympathy, empathic awareness. And awareness itself, as I say, awareness can be with anything. Awareness can be with anything. So if you're finding a sense of overwhelm, that, oh my God, I can't be with this, then the next creative step is to sort of kind of recognise that, perhaps using this presence language, oh, something in me is finding this totally overwhelming, totally impossible to manage. Try being with that something that's finding it impossible. Okay, I'm not going to go there, I'm just going to sit with this part of me that can't go there. Okay. And then, because each time we do that, we're moving more into awareness. And awareness can be with anything. It doesn't have any preferences. Yeah. Wherever there's a preference, there's a something there that we can kind of bring awareness to, or be with. And I wanted to drop in a quote from one of my favourite Zen sources. This is from the Sin Sin Ming, very short, beautiful little text written by the third Chan patriarch. So Chan was the Chinese precursor of the Zen tradition in Japan, started up by Bodhidharma, who came from India, came from the West, and then he had a disciple, I can't remember the name of, and his disciple was Xuan Zang, who wrote the Sin Sin Ming. So this is from very early on. And the opening line of the text is, the great way is not difficult for those who are not attached to preferences. The great way is not difficult for those who are not attached to preferences. I'm told this is a more accurate translation. The other translation I have is, the grey way is not difficult for those who have no preferences.
Mm.
But in a way, that's a bigger ask, having no preferences. it's a bigger ask than not being attached to them. Mm. And not being attached to them is more relevant here. It's like, okay, so there are likes and dislikes. There are preferences. There are wanting, not wanting going on. I can just bring awareness to them, because awareness itself, it has no preferences. Yeah. And to come from awareness is to be beyond attraction and aversion. It's to be beyond likes and dislikes, beyond hopes and fears, not to be attached to preferences. Hopes and fears is an interesting take, in a way. It's more the language of the Kagyu tradition, which the Sandra is very rooted in, and I've been really getting a lot from the Sandra's retreat, so I'm sort of, I'm coming more into relationship with this language of hopes and fears. It's talking about the same area. Okay, so then Mifan goes on to say, which is beginningless and unfabricated. So again, pure awareness, beginningless and unfabricated. And I'm taking this in the same spirit as the previous line. Anything which has a beginning, anything which is fabricated, is something I can bring awareness to. Okay. So all experience has its beginning, has its unfolding, has its ceasing. All of that happens in awareness. Okay. Everything in experience confirms awareness. There is no experience that we ever have that we were not aware of. In a way, that's fairly obvious, really. So we're continually aware of experiences beginning, arising. And another way of putting that is that whenever we're experiencing a beginning, an arising, an emergence, that's something we can bring awareness to. It's not awareness in itself. Okay. Unfabricated. So not made, not put together, not confected, not contrived. Sometimes the tradition talks of uncontrived awareness. I quite like the phrase uncontrived awareness. It's not something that you're kind of manufacturing, putting together. So it's not the toothpaste tube approach to meditation practice, where you know, you've got a little bit of toothpaste left in the tube and you're kind of squeezing it out. So I don't know if you've ever experienced Metta Bhavana in that manner of trying to squeeze the last bit of metta out of the tube. So that would be trying to contrive an experience of metta. But again, in a way, however subtle that way may be, all of our experience is fabricated. All of our experience is kind of something that is conditioned. So conditioned means two principal distinct things. It means it arises in dependence upon a cause. So it's like more of an over time. This happens and that happens. There's conditionality in play over time. But at any one time, conditionality means that something is compounded. It's made up of bits. It's a fabrication, in a way. So all of our experience is fabricated. And it can be quite helpful to look at the way in which something that's just very familiar, that you might just assume is a direct perception of the real way things are, is something that you're kind of putting together in your mind. So the idea of near and far, for example, you know, the idea that I live in this space and some things are nearby and some things are far away, well, how do I know that? You know, how do I know that Trish is further away than Alison? You know, and then when you reflect on that, you realise, oh, well, it's because of this and this and this, and I'm perceiving it that way for a reason. Yeah. So it's something I'm kind of putting together. Even this sense of the space in which my visual experience is happening.
Your voice is getting softer again.
Is it? Sorry. Do you say?
Just like that.
Okay. It's a habit of mine, I'm afraid. Okay. So the suggestion is, experience is itself fabricated. Anything that is fabricated is something we can bring awareness to. Yeah, just as anything which has a quality of attraction or aversion is something you can bring awareness to. Anything that should have a sense of originating, arising, beginning, can bring awareness to that. Anything we have the sense of, it's kind of contrived, fabricated, compounded, made up of bits, we can bring awareness to that. And what is this awareness that we're bringing to experience? Well, PFAM says it's the primordial purity of the immaculate Dharmakaya, which sounds pretty steep, but hey, if Mara Vera can give a talk on the Dharmakaya on the Sangha weekend, why not? So purity. So purity, I think, in the sense of unmixed. So pure alcohol is alcohol that has no water mixed in with it, no flavouring, it's just alcohol. Pure water is water that has no alcohol mixed in with it, no flavouring, no grit, no colouring, no dye, no silt. It's just water. Yeah. So pure awareness has nothing else mixed in with it. It's just awareness. I think for myself in particular, it's not got any identification mixed in with it. It's not me, it's not my awareness, it's not something I'm doing, it's just awareness, it's just happening. Any sense of me, mine, something I'm doing, is something I can bring awareness to. You know, perhaps it's something that we're not familiar with bringing awareness to, but it's something we can bring awareness to.
Could you just repeat that?
Okay. The primordial purity of the Immaculate Dharmakaya. So I'm talking about purity here, and purity in the sense of unmixed. It's just what it is. So pure water is just water. So I want to distance myself from any sort of religious connotations of the word purity. it just means in itself, natural, pure awareness. And anything which is mixed in is something we can bring awareness to. Yeah. So a particular experience is kind of mixed into awareness. We can bring awareness to that. But also, awareness can be mixed in the sense of we can be very identified, you know, with a point of view. This is me with my point of view. But actually, that's just something that's mixed into awareness. So if there's a sense of, no, this is me, this is how I see things, this is my perspective. That's actually something we can bring awareness to. Yeah. And it's not something we're probably very familiar with bringing awareness to, but it is something we can bring awareness to. So in itself, awareness is actually quite impersonal. Because, well, what does it mean to be personal? You know, I've got all my little ways, I've got my habits, I've got my character traits, I've got my perspectives, I've got my attitudes and my memories. I can bring awareness to all of those things. Yeah. So none of those things in itself is awareness. Anything which is kind of personal to me, I'd suggest, is something that I can bring awareness to. Any memories, any habits, habitual moods, attitudes. Yeah. So all the personal stuff is something that I can bring awareness to. So I'm encouraging us all to sort of make a bit of a practice of just bringing awareness to experience is a very broad encompassing term. Hopefully it's broad enough and encompassing enough. Bring awareness to anything which you can bring awareness to. And in this way, the quality of awareness becomes more apparent. In particular, the quality of purity in the sense of just natural, pure awareness that's unmixed with anything else. You know, that doesn't have any likes and dislikes, any preferences. It's just awareness. And in the end, this is the Dharmakaya, and for me this is a way of saying that in the end, ordinary human awareness is not different from enlightened awareness. Yeah. It's just awareness. Yeah. So enlightened awareness is awareness that's free, that's unconditioned by greed, hatred and delusion. Yeah. So greed, hatred, and delusion, they're not awareness in itself. They're things that you can bring awareness to. Awareness in itself is not greedy. It's not hateful. And it's not deluded in the sense of... Well, delusion in Buddhist terms means a deliberate turning away from experience. Yeah. So I don't happen to know the capital of Patagonia. Yeah. So in that sense, you could say I'm ignorant of the capital of Patagonia. That's not ignorance in the sense of avidya. It's not ignorance in the Buddhist sense. So the Buddha didn't know the capital.
But you know,
my belief is.
It didn't exist then.
Yeah.
I'm
thinking that it's a deliberate turning away because it's tinged by craving and aversion.
Yeah, particularly aversion, yeah, or a desire. So the way Dzogchen Rinpoche puts it, another one of Bantu's Nyingma teachers, he's saying, well, everything's actually at root desire. Ignorance is a desire not to be involved with, not to be troubled by, not to have to worry about. Yeah. So I just don't want to know. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So the desire not to know. And obviously aversion is the desire not to have to deal with, not to know. So aversion is also desire. And desire is not in itself awareness. Desire is something we can all bring awareness to. Yeah. So that, in a way, that's why ordinary awareness is not different from enlightened awareness. Yeah. Because what's different is not in itself awareness. It's the obscurations, the poisons, the passions, the obscuring views. They're all things we can bring awareness to. Yeah.
Can I ask you a question? Mm. How does it work when, say, you have a friend who is incredibly toxic and is giving you all this really bad? It's really, really hard to be with that energy. So by me not wanting to spend time with somebody who's like that in order to kind of protect myself, I'm also actually turning away from it because I just don't want to deal with it.
So that's a good, that's a good example of what I was suggesting earlier, that you might find that I'm not able to turn towards this. Yeah, or to put it another way, in more presence language, something in me really doesn't want to have to face this. Okay. So then the suggestion is bring awareness to that something that's finding it really difficult, that really can't face this at the moment, that just needs to turn away. Yeah. So I'm not suggesting we make a practice of not doing it. It's like just stop all the greed, stop all the hatred. If you can do that, then great, go for it. But my suggestion here is to bring awareness to what you can bring awareness to. You know? And if you find that there's something that I really can't turn towards that, then just recognise that. Something in me really can't turn towards this. Bring awareness to that something.
I think that's the hardest thing, though, isn't it? Because there's so many people with that. And I used to be, I probably can be cut like that as well. It's not until you kind of find the sangha that you realise, I realised how toxic everything was. And, I really feel it now when I'm with my other friends in normal life. I just don't feel the energy just drain out of me, and I'm like, oh my God, I'm depressed.
So there may well be lots of people you're finding really toxic. Perhaps there's only the one sort of aspect of you that's finding life like this. You know? So that's the one thing. That's the one thing you can kind of turn towards, bring along to.
I'm just thinking,
maybe we can sort of move on, and there's probably like opportunities to sort of open up a wider discussion in a bit, but I would like to sort of cover the sort of suggestion, and then we can give it a go in a lead meditation and then move on. Yeah. Is that okay?
Yeah, that's great.
Okay, because there's another couple of bits. There's two more themes really in this. Next slide, in which all appearances arise like magical illusions. So in awareness, appearances arise. So that's straightforward, isn't it? Like magical illusions. Maybe that needs a bit of unpacking. So when we've got a feel for awareness, we have this sense of experiences arising in awareness. as appearances. So perhaps you get a sense that actually everything we're experiencing is a sort of sense impression, which is an impression in awareness. One quote from Banti is that everything we perceive is a perception. So it seems quite simple when you put it that way, but actually it's quite challenging to take on board. And perception, which is sanya, in Buddhist, the Buddhist word, is said to be like a mirage, so there's this classic set of metaphors or similes for the five skandhas, one of which is perception, said to be like a mirage. But if you imagine sunlight shining obliquely on hot sand, produces the image of a lake. So there's this clear visual image, manifestly apparent and demonstrably present as an appearance of a lake. There's this lake, I can see it. But if you try and get hold of a lake, if you try and drink the water, you'll find there's nothing there. It's a mirage. And those of you who were there last weekend on the Sangha retreat will remember Dogen Ketsen Rinpoche's simile for the rainbow. Yeah, it's vividly apparent, it's colourful, it's bright, it's demonstrably present in awareness. And you can't clothe yourself in a rainbow. You can't get hold of it. You can't make an ornament of it. There's no substance to it. So in that sense, it's like a magical illusion. It's a coming together of conditions which is manifestly apparent to our senses. It appears. You can't deny the appearance of it, but you can't get hold of it. Because whatever you try and get hold of, you just get hold of another sense impression, another perception, another appearance. I might think I've really got hold of this sofa now, but it's just another, it's just a tactile sense impression. Okay. The inseparability of form and emptiness. Yeah. So it's manifestly apparent, it's demonstrably present to our senses, it appears, we can't deny that, it has its form. And there's nothing there we can get hold of. It's not got anything substantial behind it. It's empty of that. Yeah. And finally, I've inverted the last line. This is the very nature of the guru. So Mipham's coming from the Padmasambhava tradition. This was actually in the context of Padmasambhava practice. The Padmasambhava is the archetypal guru, so that's why he's using the word guru. But here you could say any Buddha or Bodhisattva figure. Yeah. The very nature of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas is the inseparability of form and emptiness, which is the same nature as all of our experience. And so we can relate to that as an opening. Yeah. Hopefully we can relate to that as an opening to the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas rather than a closing down, rather than thinking, oh, they're all just a magical illusion. There's nothing substantial to the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. That would be a bit of an unfortunate attitude. There's nothing separating from me from the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas because I'm immersed in the world of appearances, which is the inseparability of form and emptiness, which is the world of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, the whole realm of visionary splendour. So if you can see the nature of your own actual experience, you're also seeing the nature of the three jewels, the nature of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. So this is the opposite of living in a solid world of solid matter that's substantial, that's real, that's materialist, which has no room in it for Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, for visionary splendour. Yeah. It's living in a world in which form, inseparable from emptiness, plays in awareness as appearance. That's the same world as the world of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. And one last quote from the Sensing Ming again, it's actually from the end of the same short text, which I think articulates this very effectively for me, is, one thing, all things move amongst and intermingle without obstruction. to live in this truth is to be without anxiety about non-perfection. To live in this faith is the road to non-duality. For the non-dual is one with the trusting mind. And I'll just drop that in once more. One thing, all things, move amongst and intermingle without obstruction. To live in this truth is to be without anxiety about non-perfection. To live in this faith is the road to non-duality. For the non-dual is one with the trusting mind. I think I'll give Swan Sang the last word and not try and explain any of that.